ladies and gentlemen, in the background, you are hearing Big Ben in Westminster Palace in London. At this time, the National Broadcasting Company combines its coast-to-coast networks to bring you a talk by Mr. Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister. Mr. Churchill will begin speaking as soon as Big Ben has finished ringing 8 o'clock, the time in London.
Before I read the news in the Home Service, listeners here and overseas will hear the Prime Minister. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Churchill.
To the British nation and empire on the broadcast. In war time, there's a lot to be said for the motto, deeds, not words. All the same, it is a good thing to look around from time to time and take stock. And certainly our affairs have prospered in several directions during these last 4 or 5 months, far better than most of us would have ventured to hope. We stood our ground and faced the two dictators in the hour of what seemed their overwhelming triumph. And we have shown ourselves capable, so far, of standing up against them alone. After the heavy defeat of the German Air Force by our fighters in August and September, Herr Hitler did not dare attempt the invasion of this island, although he had every need to do so, and although he had made vast preparations. Baffled in this grandiose project, he sought to break the spirit of the British nation by the bombing first of London and afterwards of our great city. It has now been proved to the admiration of the world and of our friends in the United States that this form of blackmail, murder, and terrorism, so far from weakening the spirit of the British nation, has only roused it to a more intense and universal flame than was ever seen before in any modern community. The whole British Empire has been proud of the mother country, and they long to be with us over here in even larger numbers. We have been deeply conscious of the love for us which has flowed from the dominions of the Crown across the broad ocean station. There is the first of our war aims, to be worthy of that love and to preserve it. All through these dark winter months, the enemy has had the power to drop 3 or 4 tons of bombs upon us for every ton we can send to Germany in return. We are arranging so that presently this will be rather the other way around. But meanwhile, London and our big cities have had to stand their pounding. They remind me of the British squares at Waterloo. They are not squares of soldiers. They do not wear scarlet coats. They are just ordinary English, Scottish, and Welsh folk, men, women, and children, standing steadfastly together. But their spirit is the same. Their glory is the same. And in the end, their victory will be greater than far-famed Waterloo. All honor to the civil defense services of all times. Emergency and regular, volunteer and professional, who have helped our people through this formidable ordeal, the like of which no civilized community has ever been called upon to undergo. If I mention only one of these services tonight, namely the police, it is because many tributes have been paid already to the others. But the police have been in it everywhere, all the time. And as a working woman wrote to me in a letter, what gentlemen they are. More than 2/3 of the winter has now gone. And so far we have had no serious epidemic. Indeed, there is no increase of illness in spite of the improvised conditions of the shelter. That is most creditable to our local medical and sanitary authorities, to our devoted nursing staff, and to the Ministry of Health, whose head, as you may have seen, Mr. Malcolm MacDonald, is now going to Canada in the important office of High Commission. There is another thing which surprised me when I asked about it. In spite of all these new wartime offenses and prosecutions of all kinds, in spite of all the opportunities for looting and disorder, there has been less crime this winter, and there are now fewer prisoners in our jails than in the years of peace. We have broken the back of the winter. The daylight grows. The Royal Air Force grows. And is already, certainly, master of the daylight air. The attacks may be sharper, but they will be shorter. There will be more opportunities for work and service of all kinds. More opportunities for life. So, if our first victory was the repulse of the invader, our second was the frustration of his acts of terror and of torture against our people at home. Meanwhile, abroad, in October, a wonderful thing happened. One of the two dictators, the crafty, cold-blooded, black-hearted Italian, who had thought to gain an empire on the cheap by stabbing fallen France in the back, he got into trouble. Without the slightest provocation, spurred on by lust of power and brutish greed, Mussolini attacked and invaded Greece, only to be hurled back ignominiously by the heroic Greek army, who, I will say, with your assent, have revived before our eyes the glories which, from the classic age, gild their native land. While Signor Mussolini was writhing and slopping under the Greek lash in Albania, Generals Wavell and Wilson, who were charged with the defense of Egypt and of the Suez Canal in accordance with our treaty obligations, whose task seemed at one time so difficult, they had received very powerful reinforcements. Reinforcements of men, cannons, equipment, and above all, tanks, which we had sent from our island in spite of the invasion threat. And large numbers of troops from India, Australia, and New Zealand had also reached them. Forthwith began that series of victories in Libya which have broken irretrievably the Italian military power on the African continent. We have all been entertained, and I trust edified, by the exposure and humiliation of another of what Byron calls those pagod things of saber sway, with fronts of brass and feet of clay. Here, then, in Libya, is the third considerable event upon which we may dwell with some satisfaction. It is just exactly 2 months ago, to a day, that I was waiting anxiously, but also eagerly, for the news of the great counterstroke which had been planned against the Italian invaders of Egypt. The secret had been well kept. The preparations had been well made. But to leap across those 70 miles of water and attack an army of 10 or 11 divisions equipped with all the appliances of modern war, who had been fortifying themselves for 3 months, that was a most hazardous adventure. When the brilliant, decisive victory at Sidi Barani, with its tens of thousands of prisoners, proved that we had quality, maneuvering power, and weapons superior to the enemy, who had boasted so much of his virility and his military virtues, it was evident that all the other Italian forces in eastern Libya were in great danger. They could not easily beat a retreat along the coastal road without running the risk of being caught in the open by our armored divisions and brigades ranging far out into the desert in tremendous sweep and scoop. They had to expose themselves to being attacked piecemeal. General Wavell, nay, all our leaders, and all their live, active, ardent men, British, Australian, Indians, in the Imperial Army, saw their opportunity. At that time, I ventured to draw General Wavell's attention to the seventh chapter of the Gospel of St. Matthew, at the seventh verse, where, as you all know, or ought to know, it is written, "Ask and it shall be given. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you." The army of the Nile has asked, and it was given. They sought, and they have found. They knocked, and it has been opened unto them. In barely 8 weeks, on a campaign which will long be studied as a model of the military art, an advance of over 400 miles has been made. The whole Italian army in the east of Libya, which was reputed to exceed 150,000 men, has been captured or destroyed. The entire province of Cyrenaica, nearly as big as England and Wales, has been conquered. The unhappy Arab tribes who have for 30 years suffered from the cruelty of Italian rule, carried in some cases to the point of methodical extermination, these Bedouin survivors have at last seen their oppressors in disorderly flight, or led off in endless droves as prisoners of war. Egypt and the Suez Canal are safe. And the port, the base, and the airfields of Benghazi constitute a strategic point of high consequence to the whole of the war in the Eastern Mediterranean. This is the time, I think, to speak of the leaders who, at the head of their brave troops, have rendered this distinguished service to the king. The first and foremost, General Wavell, commander-in-chief of all the armies of the Middle East, has proved himself a master of war, sage, painstaking, daring, and tireless. But General Wavell has repeatedly asked that others should share his fame. General Wilson, who actually commands the Army of the Nile, was reputed to be one of our finest tacticians, and few will now deny him that quality. General O'Connor, commanding the 13th Corps, with General Mackett, commanding the splendid Australians, and General Craig, who trained and commanded the various armored divisions which were employed, these three men executed the complicated and astoundingly rapid movements which were made and fought the actions which occurred. I've just seen a telegram from General Wavell, in which he says that the success of Benghazi was due to the outstanding leadership and resolution of O'Connor and Craig, ably backed by Wilson. I must not forget here to point out the amazing mechanical feats of the British tanks, whose design and workmanship have beaten all records and stood up to all trials, and show us how closely and directly the work in the factories at home is linked with the victories abroad.